This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Adam Ragusa in from Meghna Chakrabarty. Earlier this month at a high school in Ohio, a teenager allegedly opened fire, killing three students and wounding two others. According to news reports, prior to the attack, the accused gunman had posted threatening messages on Facebook and Twitter.
The Ohio shooting was almost certainly on the minds of Attleboro police last week when they arrested 18-year-old Natick Sands and 20-year-old Ryan Ringette. The two were arrested after posting comments on Facebook about a shooting spree at the Attleboro High School.
Some took the comments as a joke, but others, like the local police and district attorney, they say that those comments constituted a credible threat. The conversation started last week when a user with Natick Sands' name posted this on Facebook, quote, "And people wonder why I talk about random mass killing sprees all the time. Fed up."
According to news reports, Ryan Ringette responded by saying, "I'm with you," and specifically mentioned Columbine, an apparent reference to the 1999 shooting at the Colorado High School that killed 12 students and one teacher. The two then discussed how the first target of the shooting would be the school police officer.
The conversation was reported to the school principal, and then police arrested Sands and Ringette last week. They were charged with the threatened use of a dangerous weapon at a school and face a maximum 20 years in prison.
So here's the question. In a post-Columbine, post-Virginia Tech era, what's the appropriate response to off-the-cuff remarks about gun violence in schools? Does freedom of speech extend to jokes about a shooting spree? And if this was mindless online chatter or joking, how should law enforcement respond? Should the judicial system send a message that these kinds of comments are just unacceptable? You can join the conversation at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And joining us now from Yale University is Emily Bazelon. She's senior editor at Slate, who's currently working on a book about bullying. And Emily Bazelon, great to have you back on Radio Boston. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us from his office in Cambridge is Harvey Silverglate. He's a Boston criminal defense attorney and civil liberties litigator. Welcome back to you, Harvey. Always a pleasure to have you.
Oh, it's good to be on this topic.
So the Facebook comments of Natick Sands, one of those arrested, are still posted. There are more than 220 responses as we counted this morning. One of the responses says this: "Joke or not, this is unacceptable. You can't take chances anymore, especially when it's about a school shooting like this." Harvey, does that comment have it right in your view?
No, but it's completely to be expected. And by the way, this is not just the post-Columbine phenomenon. It's also a post-9/11 phenomenon, which suddenly a joke made on a waiting line to get onto an airplane becomes an arrestable offense. The country has gone into overwhelm on the side of preventing violence as a result of 9/11 and Columbine. And we're now seeing the results.
And so the result, in your view, is what, a little too quick to the draw on the part of law enforcement?
Well, it's not so much too quick to the draw. It's that there's a total overreaction and an inability to step back. I'm not saying that you see something like this on Facebook, you do nothing. But have school authorities and police ever heard of just showing up and talking to the kids and finding out what's going on? The fact that arrest and charging a crime and setting high bail is the first reaction rather than the last reaction after investigation is what is so stunning about the post-9/11 era that we live in.
Mm. Emily, do you agree? Do you think the police in this case overreacted? Harvey talked about arresting them quickly, setting a high bail. And they're in jail, and there's a real concern here about what they might have done.
I think it's clear that the police had to check out what was going on. When you see things like this on Facebook, you can't afford to just let them go, because it's only when you investigate that you find out how credible a threat this is. But the district attorney in this case said that she thought this was a credible threat, and that's the basis for this arrest and prosecution. And just from reading the quotes online and what the friends of these two people were saying, it sounds like that's a real reach. And so where I agree with Harvey is that, you know, criminal prosecutions should be something that are arrived at with hesitation in situations like this. And if it's clear that people are joking, then there's no reason to up the ante to this degree.
Mm. And Emily, what's the significance that this occurred on Facebook. In other words, if instead someone had overheard a conversation between Sands and Ringuette and had reported that to the school or police, do you think we would have seen a different kind of chain of events? What's the significance?
Well, I think it would have been different because when you have people reporting, you inevitably have a kind of he said, she said, and the conversations are out there somewhere in the ether. But when you have screenshots or printed out electronic records, suddenly the words seem very stark and serious, and they start driving a lot of action by school officials, by cops, that I don't think that witness reports. And who knows, you know, if the people who had actually been hearing this face to face had heard this and it was really a joke, they wouldn't have reported it. It's the combination of the way in which Facebook has an illusion of privacy for some people, but is actually very public. I think that's part of what's driving the story.
But Harvey, to push back a little bit against your position, aren't the cops and the DA in an impossible situation here? I mean, I have a ton of respect for your principled defense of people in this situation, of First Amendment rights. But if this is happening in a school where my kids are going, I'd be pretty alarmed. I mean, wouldn't you be?
Well, actually, I wouldn't be. I have a son who went through a public school system in Cambridge from kindergarten right through high school. And I can't tell you, his friends frequently played at my house because we had the most food available for them.
And sounds like the place to be.
I can tell you that I heard remarks very much like this quite commonly. The problem really is that we have a new sieve through which we look at life. And that's the sieve of, you know, terrorism, bombings, attacks, Columbines, and that has really changed everything. And the real question I have is, and I don't mean to reverse the roles here, do we really want to live in a society where we have allowed a couple of events to change everything about the way we live and the way we treat our kids, by the way? That's the question we have to face. Is it really that different? You know, we're not the only ones facing this. Kids aren't the only ones facing this. There's an organization called the Humanitarian Law Project that went to the Supreme Court trying to get a definition as to what they could and could not do in their effort to achieve peace and reconciliation without being deemed to be in violation of this incredibly vague federal law about making it a felony to render material assistance to terrorists. One reads the Supreme Court opinion and has no better idea now what one does to violate that statute than before the case was decided. So we are in an era of vague statutes. We're in an era of overreaction.
Well, overreaction. On the other hand, Emily Bazelon, you know, I was reading in doing some research for this project, when you look at the terrible record of gun violence in this country, particularly shootings at schools, after the fact, there were warning signs that, you know, had they been heeded, some of these school massacres might have been prevented. So I guess sort of I want you to chime in on this conversation. Aren't the authorities in a terrible bind here when they see an indication of possible violence coming?
Yes, I think that particularly school officials are really stuck. School shootings are increasing, not decreasing. I didn't know that until the Ohio shootings last week, but that is in fact the case. And so in retrospect, it is often easy, it looks easy to connect the dots and see that someone was sending out warning signs, as you were saying. And then it's a very quick step away from blaming the school authorities or whoever is deemed to have missed those warning signs. And I think that's what you're seeing here in the school reporting this kind of Facebook aggression to the cops. I think the problem is then what happens. I mean, as a parent, I would certainly want these kids reported and investigated, but I think the question is whether they really needed to be criminally charged.
Yeah. So what would be better, Harvey, to come back to you, what would have been a better approach? You suggested try talking to them, trying to figure out what's going on, but who should do the talking and what should we be talking to them about?
I hate to sound like an old fogey, but when I went to high school in Bogota, New Jersey, there was a fellow named Raymond Waters. He was the vice principal. any hint that there was a student who was planning to do something that was no good, that student would be called in to sit down for 20 minutes to have a face-to-face with Ray Waters. He was good enough at his job because of experience that he would be able to figure out whether there's a real problem here and if he had to take it further. We seem to lack people who have that skill and particularly that discretion today, because everybody talks about zero tolerance for violence. And what that means is we way, way over-prosecute and over-punish kids who actually or not don't pose a danger at all. It's an issue of the psychology of the times we live in. And do I have a solution for it? Well, I'll tell you one thing that isn't a solution. Vastly increasing the number of bureaucrats in our schools, because when you have that many bureaucrats in violence prevention, they really need something to do. And so these cases get over-reported, over-treated, over-responded to. So I think we have to go back to a simpler and more personal approach where there's somebody in the school who knows the kids and can call them in and have a talk. And if they think the police have to be involved, then they'll call the police, who also should be who should interview before they bring a charge.
So there's a point of view, listeners, and in a post-Columbine, post-Virginia Tech era, what's the appropriate response to what might be off-the-cuff remarks about gun violence in schools? That's the question we're asking. 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's go to Metin from Brookline. Metin, good to have you on the show.
Hi, thanks for taking my comment.
Sure.
So I'm actually a junior at Brookline High School, and we had a similar situation where two students threatened, made some threatening remarks online, and they were taken in. The police and the school got involved, but they didn't end up being prosecuted. They were just suspended. And I think that, personally, as a student, it's terrifying. I think, you know, it's one thing to joke about, you know, oh, how I hate my school online, but it's another thing to actually say things like massacre. And I think that, you know, there's a tendency of adults to sometimes think that, oh, you know, kids, a lot of times it's just they're doing stupid things. But over and over again, unfortunately, we see that they have the capability to do this. So I think, you know, first thing should be action and then talk. And third should be prosecution. But I think, you know, you have to get to these people before they should do it, because, you know, we can't just say, oh, you know, we're just going to talk to them. But then if it doesn't work, then we're left with a problem that could potentially lead to bloodshed.
Metin, great to have your perspective on this. Thanks so much for the call. Emily, Harvey a moment ago was talking about a sort of simpler approach to this. Do you see a sort of simpler way to respond? When I listened to Metin's comment there, I sort of heard, I don't know, a sort of middle of the road. I mean, take it seriously, but talk to these people before something bad can happen.
Well, and I think Metin was also giving us a good reminder that when you're going to school every day and people are making threats like this, it can be alarming and scary to feel like, and there's good reason to feel like it could be a real possibility based on other events far away from your school. It may not, usually it's not going to happen at your school, but it's hard not to feel affected by the psychology of that.
Sure.
And, you know, in terms of a simpler approach, I actually have a fair amount of sympathy for schools in these situations. I don't think they're filled with uncaring bureaucrats. I think that they are really burdened by this whole question of how much responsibility they have for the speech the kids do online. If they don't address it at all and act as if it's not their problem, and then something goes wrong, then they can often be judged to be on the hook. And that's a real difficulty for them that we need to help schools figure out.
Harvey, is law enforcement, are there legal grounds to, I mean, and is this, I think this might get to part of your concerns, to prosecute in order to send a message?
Well, we are in an era now which is characterized by extremely vague statutes in any area involving prevention of violence. That's why I brought up the humanitarian project, legal project, that the Supreme Court, you know, tried to clarify the statute and really couldn't. So we're in that kind of an era, and we're in an era of over-prosecution. Some of the terrorism, so-called terrorism cases, would have been a joke 15 years ago, and now people are actually getting convicted, sentenced to 30 years, and their convictions are being affirmed by the federal courts, even though nobody still can understand why what they did was a crime. So we are in a new era. It's a dangerous era. I can understand why school officials engage in what I call overreaction. They're afraid of being criticized. And by the way, I don't say that the school is filled with heartless bureaucrats, but I think there are far too many bureaucrats in the student life arena. And, you know, they have to fill up their day, and they end up trying to micromanage the lives of the students, and this is not good for education either.
Let's go to David, who's calling from Lexington. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. I have 2 points that I'd like to make. I am a public school teacher, so I do have that bias going into this comment. Number one, my concern is that I feel Harvey made the presumption that the students are innocent and that there was no credible threat. Maybe, just maybe, the police did do the investigation, that school officers did do the investigation, that the DA did do the investigation and determined that there was a credible threat. And if there was a credible threat, instead of saying that they've just made a huge error, maybe they just prevented a huge disaster. My second comment also is directed at Harvey, and that comment is that in order for schools to have an assistant principal, an associate principal, somebody with the authority to address the students, we need parents who are responsive to a phone call from the school and don't just automatically assume that their child could never do such a thing.
Well, let's take up that first point first, David. Harvey, you're not giving the police the benefit of the doubt here. If they arrested, maybe, just maybe, they deemed it was a credible threat.
Actually, I doubt it very much, but I guess we'll see as the case plays itself out. But I would be willing to make a substantial wager that it's going to turn out that no thinking person in the end is going to think that these kids really were intending to do any violence. I could be wrong, but I've represented enough. I've done this enough in my career.
Sure.
That I think I got a good ear for it.
And Emily, respond to David's suggestion that parents really need to be sort of more involved in responding to some of this stuff, particularly as it pertains to this new world of social media.
It's totally true that parents should be on top of this, and it's also really hard to do. I mean, we're talking about an 18-year-old and a 20-year-old in this case, and parents, I think even parents who deeply care about their children and are trying to be involved are really struggling with the degree of freedom that social media and online activity gives them. And, you know, you can't monitor every single thing your kid says if they're 18 or 20. You have to more invest in trying to inculcate in them the kinds of values that will lead them to exercise good judgment. Mm. But nobody's perfect, and sometimes kids mess up.
Let's go to another call. Karen is calling from Bolton. Hi, Karen.
Hi. My son goes to school at the Sudbury Public Schools. I'm divorced, but my son's a straight A student. And
you said a straight A student. Is that what you said, Karen? A straight
yeah.
A student. Gotcha.
Yeah. So. Right. He's never gone to the office through elementary school or anything. And he was having a math test when he was in seventh grade, and the kid next to him was pulling his math papers off the desk and ripping them up. And so the teacher heard Frankie say, you know, I'm going to kill you if you keep ripping up my math papers. So we were called in, and we were sat down with his advisor and the guidance counselor, and they told us that they were very close to calling the police on Frankie for saying, I'll kill you for ripping up his math test. And I felt like there was a real overreaction that, you know, my ex-husband works at the Brigham, is a doctor at the Brigham, and we really are involved with Frankie, and he has never done anything violent in his life. He's a very serious student. And
so this was Frankie just using sort of hyperbolic language in the way that kids often do, and you feel that the response was a little over the top, right?
Well, they were going to call the police
because
he said the word kill, and they have a no bullying tolerance in Sudbury. So there's no, and so it turns out that the kid who has done this, now he's been taken out of the school because he's what you would call quote unquote a bully. But what happened after that is the no bullying rule, it means that you have to eat lunch with, you know, whoever sits next to you, have to sit next to them. And so this kid would come sit next to Frankie and taunt him and say, oh, I got you in trouble. And, you know, and so this bullying policy kind of turned backwards. And the teachers knew.
Let me get Emily Bazelon into this, because, Emily, you're writing a book on bullying. I'm just wondering what you hear in Karen's concern here.
Well, I hear a parent who's frustrated with the policy that's being applied in a blanket way without any of the discretion that Harvey was talking about earlier. We need schools to be able to make judgments that are not just following some policy written on a piece of paper. And if they're not able to do that, then you have these situations where kids realize that things are unfair. And then part of why they're acting out or not behaving exactly the way they are supposed to is they can sense that there's something off here.
Right. Let's take another call. Vincent is calling from Winchester. Hi, Vincent.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well. What's on your mind?
Well, the more I listen now, my opinion has changed a bit, and I really am amazed at how inept a lot of people are that really could have kept this under control. First of all, I really find that the depth job of finding out what happened, the principal and the guidance counselor. And if nothing was working there with the communication with the students, then you call your community officer, which many police departments have. But before even you call a community officer, a lot of times now under federal grants and state grants, which come from the feds, officers are stationed in the school. They do nothing. They're hidden. They're nowhere to be found. But they're there. They're being on the payroll for being at that school. So it is amazing that it went this far, because you could see how the kid was crying on the news, that this could have been dealt quietly, quickly, efficiently with the parents and the boy and boys. You know, it's a tragedy. It's gone this far, and it angers me a little, because then you see the money that's wasted on law enforcement and hazardous waste units that even show when you already acknowledged that it was just a threat online.
Sure, Vincent. Okay, we got the point. Thank you very much for the comment. Harvey, Vincent seems to be sort of, wishing for what you were describing as something simpler and maybe a slightly closer to home response.
And also more realistic. I mean, I think that what Vincent says is very true. It happens. I've dealt with a lot of police officers in my career. They actually have an enormous amount of common sense that's based upon long experience. And I don't think that a police officer allowed to react as he wishes, he or she wishes, would have this reaction. But there is, you know, district attorneys don't like to get criticized. The media jumps on it. And suddenly the zero tolerance people are out there. And we're in an era when people with common sense are afraid to exercise it.
Emily, last question that I have for you, and that is, you know, this incident was apparently reported by another student who saw the posting on Facebook. And I'm just wondering if that suggests to you that schools, and maybe in this particular case, have to do a better job at sort of policing themselves in terms of what's on Facebook, what's on these social media outlets.
I actually think that's a mistake. There's just, it's too much work. It's too hard for schools. They can't be responsible for trolling social media sites looking for comments their students are making. I mean, that would raise big First Amendment concerns. And I think it's also just not feasible. So to me, the notion that a student saw this and reported it, that seems okay. That student clearly either didn't know these kids or knew them and thought, God, maybe they could do something horrible like this. And either way, we should send the message to kids that they can turn to adults for help when they need to.
Well, we'll leave it right there. Fascinating story, fascinating conversation. And listeners, the conversation continues at radioboston.org. Emily Bazelon, senior editor at Slate. She's currently working on a book about bullying. Thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And Harvey Silverglate, Boston criminal defense attorney and civil liberties litigator, thank you for joining us today. We appreciate it as well.
Right. Thank you for not threatening me.
Well, I wouldn't dare. Stay with us. Coming up, will fasting a day keep the doctor away? Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks with Adam Ragusa. This is Radio Boston.